Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Fiona Holland, who is CEO of Tritech, a business making plant-based chemicals for the agriculture, coatings, and mining industries. I've known Fiona since way back in 2018 when she joined Tritech as operations manager and then later stepped up to become CEO as the founder retired from operations to become chairman of the board as the majority shareholder. Later, Fiona went through my 12-month CEO masterclass to develop the Tritech strategic plan and began the implementation journey. Since then, I've watched with pride as she's grown from strength to strength. Fiona, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's a privilege to be here and share some of my experiences.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. So, Fiona, today we're going to talk about the challenges that medium-sized business founders and CEOs face when they step out of the business and take the role of investor, board member, and governor, and are replaced in the day-to-day role by a professional with tier one or broad industry experience. But first, tell me a bit about your journey. How did you first get interested in the chemicals industry and how did that journey evolve?
Probably came from a love of problem solving and mathematics. I was obviously quite good at that at high school, and I was really, really fortunate enough even in high school, I had some really great mentors, both at school and outside of school, and they both encouraged me to actually do things outside the norm for that time. It was quite unusual for females at the school I was attending to do high level maths. And as part of that process and the marks I was fortunate enough to achieve, I was able to get into Melbourne Uni and I started chemical engineering. And back in those days, a lot of the businesses would come to the universities and give you a bit of an idea about what career paths they offer. And one of the companies that I talked to at the time was ICI, a British company that was very prevalent in Australia at that time in the chemical industry. And they offered me a position on their grad program, which really set me up for a very dynamic and a varied career in the chemical industry.
Well, that would have given you access to a broad range of experiences. I remember when I joined Deloitte, you know, you typically went through a rotation and got lots of experience in different areas before you settled down. So how did that go?
And that was really good. I started off, I'm Melbourne based. So I started off at the facility they had at Deer Park, and that was huge back then. It's a shadow of its former self these days. And I was able to work in the explosives industry. And back in the early 90s, explosives really took off. And so there were many, many career opportunities. And one of the ones I got offered was going to Queensland and then New South Wales to be heavily involved in the rollout of the initiating explosives program that they had back then. And that was really, really innovative and really exciting. And I was exposed to many, many different industries and activities that were going on. They were doing lots of innovation, lots of rollouts, lots of training. So as a grad, I was able to be involved in many different avenues of the business. And that was, it was a great privilege, and probably only realised it many years later what a fabulous start it was in the industry.
And that really sort of was the start of your tier one chemical industry experience too, because, you know, that would have been a fairly well-regulated, well-managed business, one of many.
Very, very well-regulated.
So after ICI, then what happened?
I pretty much stayed in the same business for most of that time. It morphed. There was lots of divestments and then acquisitions. And I kind of would say my first 20, 25-odd years was actually with the same company. It became Orica, and the division that I was working on, which was the plastics division, was sold off to ExxonMobil and became Qenos. And then as the part I was working with in Qenos got bought back by ICI and became their plastics division. And then I moved into the specialty chemicals business at Deer Park. And that's where I got introduced to Tritech Chemicals, which is where I am now. And all through that, I had a very diverse set of roles. I worked in quality assurance, in engineering, in supply chain, in customer service. You know, so it's really, when you work in large organisations, there's just so many opportunities to diversify your career.
And such a fantastic training ground.
Yes, indeed.
Because you're really learning how to do it at a tier one level all the way through, which is fantastic.
Correct.
So to get us started, coming from a tier one chemical manufacturer, how did you find the transition to a mid-sized private company?
Very challenging. Very challenging. In a big organisation, you are surrounded by expertise. In every department, at every level, you've got people who've been working, say, in engineering, responsible engineers in mechanical, electrical, chemical, and some of those have been in the industry for decades, 30, 40 years, in particular in a company like Orica. And you have the ability to draw on them. You see them regularly at company-facilitated programs. If you are stuck, you get to access that rich history. Moving out of Orica and into Tritech, that was all gone. And it was quite confronting. It was like, okay, so now I'm, at that stage, I was the operations manager. And I think, you know, the company had sub 20 people in the company, and there was no one who had a similar history to myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the work was done by people that had been in Tritech for a long period of time. The two owners had been there for a long time, but a lot of the staff had been, they're very loyal and they'd been there for many years as well. So the diversity, the richness of, you know, successes and failures wasn't there. And I was fortunate enough, I'd had some successes and failures. So I came into the organisation perhaps with a little bit of a different perspective and was able to see things that the current people weren't seeing. And that was both challenging but a great opportunity.
Yeah. I certainly remember my transition when I left Deloitte some 15 years ago and established a mid-sized business. It was quite confronting because all of a sudden you go from having 140,000 people around the world where you can find an expert in anything to being in a team of 25, when all of a sudden you've got a problem with your computer, you reach out for tech support and you realise that you are tech support. So,
yes. And safety and quality. And
safety and quality and governance and financial reporting and dashboard analysis and of course, HR. So, Fiona, when you stepped into a business built by founders with decades of practical hands-on experience, from your perspective, what were the biggest differences that you noticed between tier one governance and a founder-led mid-market business?
Yeah, you touched on it before. It's that structure that wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, they'd grown very, very rapidly the previous decade. They'd done a lot of quite innovative things and grown capitalising on customer demand and had been very, very successful, but it had all been based on people. So everything was managed by those people who worked in the organisation, and they didn't have systems and structure and a shared sense of purpose from a strategic perspective. They were, whenever a problem arose, they just basically put their heads together and started implementing whatever was a potential solution. And that was very, very different to what I had experienced in the past where, you know, the caution involved any capital spend in any system change would have been well thought out, would have been controlled by a committee to and it was gone through its implementation process. And here I had two owners in the business, one the founder and one a partner that had come on later in the stage, pretty much managing everything between the two of them. You know, one was very engineering focused and one very technical and sales focused, and so great blend. But between the two of them, they were basically almost doing decision making through a relationship that they had with each other. It made them very agile. It enabled them to make decisions really, really quickly. But from my perspective coming in, it was like, this is just so different to what I'm used to. Oh, I have to unpack that. I have to understand how I fit in here. How I make decisions. I'm not an owner. I I don't have that authority. I don't have that delegation of authority, but there's still so much I'm responsible for and I need to do and establish. And so unpacking that and working with those two owners was an amazing challenge. And it's taken us, been there for nearly a decade now, and we're still going through that journey as the business grows and changes.
Yeah, and morphs. And so stepping into the CEO seat after the founder retired from day-to-day operations, what did you find were the real challenges in establishing your authority, not just in title, but in day-to-day decision-making? Because, that's not an easy transition. You've got people who've been in the business for 30, 40 years. I mean, most of the staff had been there for a long time. So their normal process would have been, oh, we've got an issue, we'll speak to one or the other of the founders. That must have been an interesting change experience.
So, obviously, a founder speaks with such authority. Even the smallest of suggestions becomes a command.
Yeah.
And that still is there while they're working in the business and while they're present. That voice is very dominant. So as you're transitioning from that management structure to a CEO/management team, you have to navigate that. And you have to do it respectfully for that founder because it's still their business. They're still very passionate about what goes on. They still want to know what's going on, and they still have to sign off on the risk that you're taking as part of that process. But you have to educate the rest of the site, the management team and the rest of the employees, that there now has to be a different way that we actually decide things, manage things, allocate capital, what we focus on, what are the critical actions that we focus on. We actually have to be really transparent and really aligned. And how do you do that is a real challenge in a small business. And you really need to take a step back. You need to actually unpack that. And it was really important that I brought the founder and the other owner along with that journey. I mean, I could see it really, really clearly. And I think that was a lot of the reason, from my background in Orica, these systems, these controls, delegation of authority, they were just normal. It's not something that I found unusual, but for them, that was very unusual. And what does that mean? Why do you need it? So you actually have to not only implement the change, but you're needing to educate in real time what was then becoming our board as to why these things were very important from their risk. And that they had taken on that risk almost as a feeling, does this feel right? Am I comfortable with this? So that is no longer now allowed because I can't just take on a risk because it feels good. I actually have to take on a risk because I understand it, I've communicated it, I've got it signed off, and now I'm actually implementing it to an agreed set of parameters. And that is a very, very different mindset, not just for the owners, but for the rest of the organisation as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it can feel really clunky from the point of view that there's a real risk of tissue rejection here from both the founders, but also from the staff, because all of a sudden you're not just transitioning in a new personality as leader, but you're also transitioning a new way of doing things that actually brings a very agile, instinctive mid-tier business that's grown up by looking at all the data, but not looking at all the data from an analytical perspective, but looking at all the data and relying on gut feel to actually make pretty informed decisions. And that decision-making process has been fine-tuned over 20, 30, 40 years by lots of experiments and lots of mistakes that always get fixed and so on. And the solution in most cases is more hard work, to then being, okay, so let's apply some tier one governance processes, which is actually how larger organisations, and we're trying to become a larger organisation, has helped reduce its risk and communicate to larger workforces. It's okay when you've got 10, 15 staff. When you've got 40 staff, you're now not talking about just having a chat to a supervisor with their team or a team leader. You're now talking about a department or a division and getting them to actually understand a process and to follow a process. A lot of the mid-sized businesses that I work with, when you start talking to them about delegation of authority, you've got a sales guy what's his level of authority? Oh, well, he goes out, gets a sale and completes it. All right, that's great. So if he sells a $1 million contract, is he authorized to sign off on that? Well, I guess so. Yeah, he always has. That's the way we've always done it. Yeah, but what if the margins are crap? Oh, well, I wouldn't want that to happen. And all of a sudden, you know, you start to look at these things, peel open the onion a bit, and you find out, well, actually, no, we don't really have a solid CapEx process. You know, if the guys think it's a good idea, well, then we just go ahead and do it. But now when you bring in an external CEO who's come from a different environment, all of a sudden they understand roles, responsibilities, accountabilities, authority, delegations, all those sorts of things, which can feel really bureaucratic.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, they actually are there to protect the investors and the board, because we really want the business to be trading in a way that isn't reliant on the founders.
Yes.
Otherwise, they'll never get their time back. And of course,
and
the other thing
truly,
is that...
won't truly exit the business.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the other thing is that, you know, every time you come in and say, well, look, I want to have a delegation of authorities matrix, or actually, I'm not sure that the way we're handling sales is a good process, or, you know, we need to increase the quality assurance or the environmental implications of that bit of hardware, you're in some ways, it might feel to the founders that you're telling them that their baby's ugly.
Yes.
Because, yes. I mean, let's face it, the business is a fundamental yes. part of their family. It's the child they've been bringing up and it's gone through.
It is incredibly, you are right, it is incredibly important to them.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, some of these things can be often seen as being criticisms as opposed to just objective observations.
Yes. I guess that's where I was very fortunate with the owners of the business, in that I slotted in, I don't think I said before, they are engineering and sales and technical based. So that operational expertise that I bought was something that they hadn't necessarily spent a lot of time on and actually didn't actually feel that they were comfortable in that space. So they welcomed that expertise that I was bringing to the business and gave me a lot of scope, which was really great. So the respect that I got from them was amazing. And that really helped, because that you can actually see that in the business from other people. You know, and it's probably a challenge for founders. If you're bringing in someone, whether they're, you know, at that time I was an operations manager and not the CEO, but even bringing in a CEO, is you've got to empower that person to make these changes, however confronting that it is to you, because they want to change this business. It's been very, very successful and, you know, and in our case, grown rapidly, 15%, you know, on average. You know, so there's a lot of pride in what you've done.
Absolutely.
But now you've got someone coming into the business saying, yes, it's great, but if we want to continue that growth journey, if in 10 years' time you want to be that, you know, 50 to $100 million business, we actually have to make changes now to facilitate that growth and to allow you to have a life, to exit the business and for the business to go on and not be dependent on you.
Yeah,
and that
absolutely.
That has been a challenging and rewarding journey at the same time.
And certainly actually, and I think that's something that often is the case with new CEOs coming into a mid-sized business, and that is, how do they establish a basis of trust and credibility? You know, who's this peanut coming in? He doesn't know the way that we've been doing it for the last 30 or 40 years. You know, it's worked pretty well then. I mean, geez, we've had 15% CAGR. What do they know? And they want to put in all these clunky processes that slow things down. You know, you can get a bit of legacy gravity. And I guess, you know, in that first 12 months, you know, it can feel quite challenging to be the new kid on the block. And in your case, you had, I guess, in some ways, the advantage of actually being the ops manager for a couple of years anyway. And because of that engineering credibility that you brought in, you're able to sort of establish yourself over an interim period. What were the key behaviours that you had to adopt early to show the organisation, once you become CEO, that you are now leading the business, not the founders?
It goes back to the power of that voice that I was talking about and actually really dealing with that. and actually having really frank conversations with a previous CEO who's also the majority owner of the business, and actually unpacking what it means for him not to be the person making all the decisions and to allowing a CEO to make that. So both being respectful for what he needs to let go. So what do I need to make sure he's in on and has and contributes to, but then ensuring that he allows me to make those decisions. And one of the biggest things that is actually was redoing our strategic plan. And that was really, really important part of that process, because it's not just trust. You actually have to be able to articulate what it is you're trying to do. And yet not just to the owners, but to your management team as well. So we actually had to go right back to basics and redo that strategic plan from scratch.
Yeah.
And actually make sure that everyone was now part of that journey. I mean, the owners had done strategic planning themselves, but again, it was very much almost between themselves, and then it was communicated. But this time we actually had to do it as a team, go through it, unpack it, redo our why. Why were we here? What was Tritech's purpose was so important, you know, and it wasn't just to make chemicals, you know, because there's lots of people making chemicals. You know, China's really good at it. So why is Tritech here? So we're actually in the solutions business, not the chemicals business. Chemistry just happens to be the tool we use to provide solutions, and really making sure that that's then our systems, our processes, our KPIs are all around that solutions-driven process, and actually explaining that to people. Actually, that was a great journey just to do that part of it with the team, and really powerful. And then a subset of that was, well, what's going to assist us in that process in our values? And we generated, as a team, we generated those values. And those two things form the foundation then for what we would, all the conversations we've had going forward. And doing it in that systematic process gives the owners so much confidence in why you're doing something and then how you're going to do it. And then linking that back to the value that you're going to bring to the business, and why is the business going to be successful going forward? So that whole process was critical to making sure that the founders could both hand over the authority to myself as a CEO, but then could actually start to segregate themselves out from the day-to-day activities.
Yeah, you know, having the leadership team not only involved was another step forward in helping both develop autonomy, but also then empower the leadership team. Whereas probably previously the leadership team were directly connected to the founders, and therefore the founders were locked into always being the solution to every problem.
Yes. And certainly they would wait for the founders to be part of every single discussion rather than taking the ownership themselves.
Absolutely.
So I often talked about it, is that it doesn't matter how effective a person is, if they're taking away autonomy from the next level down, then that effectiveness is so diluted. Everyone needs to be functioning at the highest level. We can't, in a small business, in a medium-sized business, you can't actually have people who aren't embracing their roles and fully present in their role. There's no placeholders in the business. Every role is critical. And so people need to be very clear what it is that they have to achieve. And they need to be committed to that process. And so that's been one of our challenges, but also one of the things that's really helped the business to continue to grow is understanding what those roles are, organizational charts, job descriptions, KPIs for those roles, and then empowering those people to deliver in those roles. Whereas when the founders are in the business, that's a lot less obvious. And there's a lot of overlap. And sometimes you will find that the owners will actually take on way too much responsibility when they should be actually holding other people accountable.
Yeah.
And because they've grown up with the business and because they actually have done all of the jobs sometimes, they can do it.
Yeah.
They absolutely can do it. But it starts to become inefficient.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And particularly as you continue to grow.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And so that's been really powerful for the organisation, just having that structure, having people in roles, and also removing people from roles when the transition that the business is making is not something where they are now fit for that role. And being quite frank, sometimes what works when you're a very, very small business doesn't work when you're a medium-sized business. Having the respect of being able to hold those conversations with the founder and actually saying, this is why we need to make changes in this area, and being quite open and honest about it, was also a great privilege to me that I was actually given that respect by the founders as part of this process.
Mm, mm. Yeah, exactly. So let's look at this from a founder's perspective, because this is where I think many businesses stumble. Yana, from your lived experience, what do you think is hardest for founders when they step out of daily operations?
Is actually having enough information to manage their risk. So when they're in the business, they are across every single detail. They know what's going on, and they are virtually signing off almost on every step of the project. They can intervene when they feel like something's not quite right. So as they step out of the business, they still want to manage that risk, but they have to do it now in a totally different way.
Mm.
And that's an educational process. That's a system generation process. Talked about it before with delegation of authority, the strategic plan with their KPIs. What are the things that we're focusing on? And then how do we report that to them so that founder still has enough information that they feel like their risk is managed?
Yes.
They feel like they understand what's going on in the business, but they're not too involved in the business that you're not creating that separation between CEO and board that you need. So you're going to transition that founder to being a board person, a chair or whatever role, director role that they're taking, and still giving them the respect and the information that they need to be successful in that role.
Yeah.
Whilst they allow you to be the CEO. And that's... For us, that's been a very iterative journey. It certainly wasn't smooth. And a lot of the things that we did up front were clunky, and, you know, sometimes they didn't work. So we had to go back to the drawing board. As the founder got further and further away from the detail, from the day-to-day, the situation changed. So you actually have to be respectful of that process as well. And we're still unpacking it. We're still going through that journey.
Yeah.
You know, one of the classics is how do you give them enough information about major capital work so that they can actually sign off on what for them is huge expense, but not so much so that they're actually getting pulled back into the day-to-day.
And they're not doing a procurement process themselves.
Correct.
Yeah.
Or running off and redesigning what you've already designed because they see a different way. And the same back again, they need to learn how to trust and to let go.
Yeah.
And that's a real journey.
Yeah. And I think it's something that founders don't understand how uncomfortable that's going to feel when you've been awash with information because you're in there the day-to-day pretty well. You know, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're thinking about it, you're hearing about it, you've got all the data and so on. And then all of a sudden, you're in a situation where you're sort of expected to look at the board pack once a month and get all of that 31 days of information in 3 or 4 pages. So that transition can't happen overnight. It is a transition that takes months. And of course, you know, there's that question about, well, you know, am I being heard? Are my opinions being valued? Can't I just go and speak to the, you know, the plant supervisor or that team lead on maintenance and just give them my 5 cents worth, not realizing, of course, that completely undermines the CEO that they brought in to manage those teams. And, you know, if you're out of the business, then also you don't actually have current information. And so you can make assumptions that are completely uninformed. That paucity of information, operational, tactical, day-to-day information that they used to thrive on just isn't there and shouldn't be there, because otherwise why hire a CEO in the first place? You might as well stay there until you
stay in the business
or die. So in my view, if it doesn't feel uncomfortable, like really uncomfortable, painfully uncomfortable, then you're not doing anything different.
And yeah, that's a very good point.
So take delight in the discomfort. But of course, you know, that trust building in all directions is a slow process, and it's an iterative process. And it is very much 2 steps forward and 1 step backwards. And sometimes it's 2 steps backwards and a step sideways. So, and of course, it's not just a conversation or a relationship between the CEO and the chairman or the board. It's also a change in the relationships between the founders and the employees, because employees often continue to call the founder for quick answers, or if they find that they're not, if they didn't get the answer that they want, you know, it's like a child going to mum, can I have an ice cream? No. Then they go and ask dad. It's the same sort of a thing. You know, from your perspective, how did you and the founders handle that period where staff often reverted to what we would call bad habits? What worked and what didn't?
You need to have the safe space to actually talk about it. That's really, really important.
Mm.
If you can't talk about it, then you can't actually unpack why the situation arose and how you could, you know, perhaps prevent it in the future. So having a trusting, respectful relationship between the CEO and the board is really important.
Mm.
And I often use a mentor to facilitate that, who's had a long standing with the business and actually providing both a sounding board to myself, but also having a rich understanding of the business so that we can actually workshop sometimes ways around it, to, so that it's not emotional, the way that you're dealing with it. You're not just heading on to it. Why did you say that? I wish you hadn't have said that. You're not having those conversations.
Mm.
You're more having conversations about, if we want the business to be in this spot, these are some of the things that we actually have to work on, because they detract from where we're trying to go. So it's having those more solution-driven conversations rather than emotional. And and you don't always get it right, but always try and approach it from that perspective. People are always trying to do their best. You know, even when we falter, we're trying to do our best, and everyone has the best interest of the business at heart. So let's then unpack the why we got into that situation and explain the repercussions of it and how just changing some things can improve. And both with the founders and with the employees. And I still having those conversations, because obviously we've got one owner that still works in the business. So it's never a problem that disappears overnight.
Yeah.
And we have to actually continue to be able to have those discussions. And I think you said it fall perfectly. It's a journey, and it will continue to go on as the business grows, whilst the founders are still in owning the business and on the board, and they're always going to want to know some of the detail that's in the business. They know people who work in the business. Sometimes they're people they interact with outside the business. In my case, I don't actually have family members in the business, but I'm sure that's a problem for a lot of people as well. But in my business, that's not one of the issues I have.
Yeah.
But we have in the past, we have had family members come in and out of some of the roles. That presents challenges as well at that stage.
Yeah, it certainly does. So what did you observe about the shift from CEO to chairman? Which parts of that role transition were the most surprising from your view?
I was actually surprised at how well the chairman actually eventually let go. Like, you know, when you look back on it, it really wasn't that long a process for him to hand over the reins, to let me make the decisions, and to be comfortable that I had the best interest of the organisation at front of mind, and that I was doing it in a controlled, systematic way that was mitigating that risk. Like, so we actually got to that point much, much quicker than I thought we would have, given that, you know, it been over 30 years, you know, almost from straight out of uni to when he retired, working in the business. So he was actually able to make that transition. And I think a lot of that was because of the work we put in,
you know,
doing the strategy, having the key things that we're working on, having them communicated monthly, providing progress against those. And when the data wasn't suitable enough, unpacking what he needed to see and actually going back and redoing what we were showing him every month. And we're still doing that process. So again, it comes back to what you said about feeling heard. You actually have to be listening to what will facilitate that transition. And that supports it to go much, much quicker than I was actually expecting, which has been really great.
Yeah, well, look, I think, you know, as an external observer, I think it's also really testament to the fact that, you know, you both went into this transition process with a mutual respect, a really strong mutual respect, both with really open hearts to make it work, and also a firm desire to trust from the get-go. And I think that has, those three things have actually helped that transition be accelerated. And of course, you know, that's always underpinned by lots of open communication. even when it felt clunky and uncomfortable, there was lots of communication. And I think that's been really helpful. And of course, it's essential going forward.
Yes. And I think from my perspective too, you know, having worked in a big organisation, some of these systems and processes were quite clear to me what I was trying to achieve and why I was trying to achieve it. It's not as clear to people who have been working in a medium-sized business that they've owned. And so, you know, having both that education and respect at the same time. So saying, well, why do I need a delegation of authority? Well, this will support you. You know, you have to manage your risk. You have to understand what power you're giving, not just to me, but to the team, because they will also be making decisions and I won't be overseeing every single line item of accountability that they have, because I will push that trust down to another level. And explaining that and explaining them why it was important to have those checks and balances, capital expenditure. You know, in the past, capital expenditure would have been done with almost a corridor discussion.
Yes.
You think this is a good idea? Roughly how much would it cost? Well, that's something I think we can afford. Let's go for it. Yeah. And that would have happened between the two owners. Mm. Great. They've got total accountability for the risk and total accountability for the money. They can do that. Now I have to flip that and I have to get my engineer to be quite systematic. What does he do? Why is he doing it? How much is it going to cost?
What's and he considered? Actually
Feed it all the way back up. And, you know, that's an education piece in itself. Because that is very different to their history. And they're very grateful once they can see, but that process is part of the journey. It's actually educating the board on some of this governance. Some of it is not for me to educate to. So they had to get their own, they had to do their own journey of getting more information. And one of the founders did the director's course, which was, I think, fabulous.
Yeah.
Because that just provides a whole different oversight. Also gives them the ability to network with like-minded people who are in the same situation and so important for them to hear outside of the organisation that what we were trying to do inside the organisation was normal.
Yeah, yeah.
And required.
Yeah.
That was really important as well.
Yeah, I think what you just said there is really important. This is normal and it's required. So what advice would you give founders who are about to retire from operational control but are staying on as investors or as a chair? Where should they start?
I think you need to go right back to the basics. You need to make sure that your strategy is refreshed. You need to make sure that you go through that process with your CEO so that you've got absolute alignment of purpose.
Yeah.
And then under that, what are the key things that you expect your CEO to work on to deliver that strategy? And how are they going to control, measure, and report against those activities? And then you'd actually need to have a good board structure. And if you don't get it right the first time, redo it. If you haven't got the internal expertise to develop that structure, go outside and get them. It is important that you actually do that part right. And you might not have it. Your CEO and you might not have it. And you probably don't. You actually do need support in that area. Even I'd had a lot of varied jobs, but they were all in a big organisation. I hadn't been a member of a board. I've been a member of a business management team, which is actually different to a board.
Yes.
And so I had to get educated in that area as well. What good governance looked like.
Yeah.
The chairman had to, the other owner had to, and we still do. And so we needed facilitation, mentoring, and education as part of those processes. And then once you've got the platform, then you can start to do that iterative approach of how you continue to grow the business without you and manage your risk all at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a hell of a lot of development for all parties, and particularly for the outgoing CEO, the chair to become, simply because there's so much stuff that they have to let go of. And I guess one of the things that really comes to mind there is that being a founder of a business you've grown from pretty well nothing much to something of significance over a 20, 30, 40 year period, it is a crucial, impossibly even a dominant part of your self-identity. And I see this with people who retire all the time. You know, all of a sudden they feel lost because, you know, they're not going off to work. It's even more so, I think, with founders and business owners when they when they exit and change roles, you know, the vacuum and the impact that it has on their sense of self and their on their identity is just massive. And that's neither a good or a bad thing. It's just the sheer reality. And it's uncomfortable as hell. And so therefore, when we feel uncomfortable, then by default, we want to revert back to what was comfortable. And that can be a real challenge in itself. So navigating the relationship between incoming CEO and founder, this relationship is absolutely critical. So Fiona, what were the most important conversations that you two had or that you needed to have to make this work?
Very first one was around the optics, you know, is to actually set up a press, even a simple matter, because my founder worked in the business for probably about 18 months after we did the role swap as the engineering manager. So that was a little bit of complexity because he was actually still in the business as he transitioned to retirement, because he didn't want to just exit, you know, on a day. Yeah. And so having him in the business, but in a subordinate role, and then allowing me to be the CEO was something that we really had to actually have a conversation about. Simple matters of, well, you actually have to sit somewhere different. You actually have to
actually
be
messy.
You have to say, we're physically going to move you. We're going to put you over in another part of the site, and you're going to interact just with your team. And so you're not going to be in the meetings. So we're going to separate you out from those, and making sure that we have those conversations respectfully. We're taking you out of the knowledge avenues that you have, and we're almost shutting you off from those so that you don't get involved in that day to day. And then eventually it came to the point where it is time now for you actually not to be involved in the day to day at all, and setting that date and actually sticking to it. Because it is hard, as you said, it is really, really hard. You know, everyone needs a purpose for getting up in the morning. And, you know, and the business has been that whole purpose for decades.
Yeah.
And now we've got to move it to something else. And working through that with the founder, allowing them to do that in their own time, at their own pace, and almost like a long goodbye, isn't it? And we had a great relationship. I mean, I'd known Greg for years. I worked with him when I was at Orica, and he's a fantastic guy, and he was always provided me with a great deal of respect. And so that did make it easier, that long history that we had and that a great relationship that we had, because we respected each other unconditionally and knew that no matter how stumbly the journey was, we were doing it to support each other. And we still do it that way.
Yeah.
And I'm quite blessed to have that relationship with him. And so whenever we have those issues where one person feels like they don't have the right voice or the right respect or the right autonomy in their decision making, we can actually have that discussion as he moved out of the business. And I think you alluded to it before, and we still iterate. He's still, he's very, very active in his post-Tritec life, which is really important. But there are times when he's perhaps not as actively engaged outside of work. There is always that challenge of wanting to then come in and see some of the detail. And then there's sometimes when we need his expertise because of his many, many years with the organisation. Sometimes he's the only knowledge bank we have. And so we have to tap into that knowledge bank respectfully so that we don't open up a floodgate for him that he's tried really, really hard to put some boundaries in.
Yeah.
So how do we actually tap into his knowledge and so that we can actually have it both ways?
Yeah.
And I think we've actually found some good ways of doing that.
But we're all humans, and so therefore there's a whole bunch of other things that play as well. So
indeed.
And so therefore it's a continuum which depends on lots and lots of open and frank and considerate communication.
Yeah.
Now, every transition of this kind has got a few gotchas, Fiona. What do you see as the hidden traps that incoming CEOs need to avoid?
That I needed to avoid? Assumptions?
Well, not necessarily you, but others.
Definitely for me. Assumptions get you into a whole pile of messy water. You can assume a lot and you can be totally wrong. in your assumptions. And that's not just with the founders, that's with your staff as well. You can assume that your staff know where the whole process is, and they don't. Actually, they don't see a lot of the dynamics that goes on with the board and the CEO as you do as you're doing this transition. And it can be really clunky for them and really quite destabilizing. And that, so I fell into that pit quite a few times, and actually having to, you know, work hard to get everyone back on an even keel sometimes. And again, coming back to the basics, you know, what's our why? What's our strategy? What are we trying to achieve? And what are the roadblocks that get in the way? And sometimes it is just getting everyone back in a room and refreshing your strategies. Yeah. We have actually done that a couple of times as well. So we did a big long process to do to redo the strategy that was many days over many months. But we've also had, you know, a 1 day or a 2 day here where we've got everyone back in the room and said, and founders as well, are we actually still right with this journey? Have we still got this right? Is those key, you know, levers that we're pulling to drive our value, are they still the right ones? And are we still aligned purpose?
Yeah.
And it's so powerful when the founder and the CEO are speaking with one voice.
Yes.
And when that stops happening, that's when you have to pick up on it quickly and redo it and spend the time and the organisational energy to actually realign people is really important.
Yeah, and it's an iterative process. And I guess for outgoing founders, Fiona, what do you think are their gotchas? Where might they unintentionally make things harder for an incoming CEO and their business?
The power of the voice is when they suggest. Suggest is a big one, because I said it before, a suggestion from a founder is a command.
Yeah.
And, you know, they sometimes forget that, particularly when they're outside the business.
Yeah,
you know,
blissfully unaware.
Yeah, but you have a conversation with people. You come in to pick up something from the organisation. So you have a gentle chat in the corridor and you pick up on something, and suddenly you've got two or three of your people, you know, off on a tangent.
Yes.
and the other one, which we talked about before, is them not having enough information and not feeling like they're managing their risks, so feeling uncomfortable with the change, not having the right information, feeling like they've lost a voice, and they don't feel like they can actually talk about that because they've given over the reins. So they're exiting the business. They're trying their best to give the CEO the authority to move forward, but they feel uncomfortable with what's going on, and they need to be very vocal about doing that in the appropriate channel, which is your boardroom.
Yeah.
So, you know, actually using that meeting to get what they need and not allowing their frustration or their fear to actually weave down into the management team and therefore appear to undermine the CEO.
Yeah.
So
unintentional.
100%. They're trying to manage their risk, trying to make sure their business is well governed.
And also deal with that loss of identity.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a real challenge. And the other challenge is, of course, is making sure that they are fulfilled outside of work.
Yeah.
And that they have a plan for themselves, and that they, you know, because work is just a huge part of their lives. You just don't take that away in overnight. And unless you've actually you've got to well think through that process. And as hard as it was having a transition plan where it wasn't one day they were there, one day they were gone. We had a transition. I think that actually really helped both parties, even though it came with warts. It was actually really helpful.
Yeah.
Because it enabled us to have a process to develop some of the answers to some of those questions.
Yeah.
Rather than just close the door and then find that we'd left a lot undone.
Yeah, absolutely. And Fiona, you were in my 2023 CEO Masterclass. How did that help you develop as a CEO?
That was a great experience. I was also fortunate enough to have my technical and sales director in it as well. So there was the two of us did it at the one time. That's the other owner of the business. And it was great for just the two of us together going through that process. So now the founder is left, and it's the two of us really needing to be totally aligned with what we were doing. Whereas before, he had done that with the other owner. So they had talked about that relationship where they would often make decisions just by having a chat in the office. So we actually had to flip that. We had to have a really good understanding between the two of us of what things we were focused on in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And to unpack that in a safe space with other CEOs and business owners, which is what mm-hmm. the masterclass is, was really powerful. Because mm-hmm. you're in a room with, you know, 8 or 10 other people, not necessarily with exactly the same journey, but with a lot of the same challenges.
Yeah.
But a different type of history. I mean, when I said before, when I worked in a big organization, you have that depth that's just there. When yeah. I did the CEO masterclass, that gave me depth back again. So suddenly yeah. I had people who you could run your strategy past and say, well, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Give us some critique and say, what do you think? And you've suddenly got this group of individuals who get what you are going through. They get what you're trying to achieve. They might not be doing a chemical manufacturing business, but the process that you're going through makes total sense to them. So they can give you advice and critique based on rich understanding of their own journey.
Mm-hmm.
That was just so powerful to have that over a period of 10 months and go through that journey together. We came out of it so much more stronger than when we went in. And the other thing, obviously, you get that ongoing network of people that you now know a dozen companies who have been through, who are at the same level. They also are interested in their strategic direction. They also interested in their why and their critical few actions. So you're actually all talking the same language, and you can have really, really great conversations when you've got issues, you know, and network and problem solve with people that are not vested in your business. They don't have ownership over the outcome, but they're a great resource for critiquing what direction you're taking.
Yeah, thank you. And what was the most important thing you took away from the experience? How were you different as a CEO coming out of it?
I was much more mindful of the communication flow with the rest of the team. There was a couple of tools we used in it to you really unpack the organisation and really work around what's important to the business, and then taking those, what are we actually now working on to improve those areas, and actually saying to the management team, these are the key levers that we've got to pull to improve our performance.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to do that? And being systematic in that rather than reactive was really great. You know, probably as an operations manager and then and early in my CEO piece at Tritech, I was much more firefighting. You know, I'm trying to do everything at once. I'm trying to be strategic. I'm trying to be a leader. But I'm also doing all these day-to-day operational activities that I hadn't let go of as part of the transition. I'm still trying to be an operations manager and everything in between. And I needed to stop doing that as much as the founder needed to exit the business. And I needed to be much more strategic in how I was in my role. And that masterclass, when I came out of it, I would have said I was a huge way down the journey of doing that in the organisation. And so we've still got our critical actions that we work on. We discuss them as part of the management team. We've got KPIs that are structured around them. So, and people can see how they flow up to our vision and our what we're trying to achieve, but also they've got clarity of purpose of what they're doing at the day-to-day, month-to-month plan.
Fantastic. Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organisation Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. And speaking of the tools, you know, during the masterclass and again just recently, you assessed the organization performance. You used the organization performance and value diagnostic. What was your experience of using that? How did that help you look at your business and your priorities differently?
It really helps to sharpen your focus. So I mean, if you look at the OPV, there's many, many, many levers on it, and you're good at some, you're okay at others, and you're not doing very well or not even thinking about some others again. And you actually breaking that down as to why are they important and what's going to be the benefit if you focus on those, is a really great way to have a conversation with your management team about what it is that we need to focus on. And you can do it very systematically, and you can repeat the process, and you can, you know, loop back to how you got to a certain spot in the journey and reevaluate if that still holds true. So it's a great foundational tool, and it really helped us get to our critical action and KPIs that we wanted to focus on. And I don't think we would have been able to unpack the chaos without it. You know, it just drives order through all of the things that you got going on. And because otherwise you're all talking at cross purposes. Everyone's got their own little personal, you know, key thing that they want to do and why they want to do it. And you know, they can, you know, oh, you know, I need to improve this system over here, or I need to have a process there, or I need to be focused on, you know, key account management or whatever it is. But that organizational performance and base really actually makes you sit down and as a team and say, what's important? What am I good at? And what do I need to improve? And then picking out the top ones and sticking to them. Rather than being everything to everything, you actually really bring it in and really target it in what you do.
And how did that help with the leadership alignment across the team? Did they, because it still allows each team to focus on their critical few, but I guess it's very much around how do they all then align to the top purpose and vision, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So we came in with, you know, like half a dozen things that we're actually really focused on. I mean, that they still break those down into their own individual actions that they're doing, so they're sub-actions, but it actually all flows through to what it is that, why Tritech is here and what it is that we're trying to achieve. And because we are solutions-driven, and that means focused on the customer and what the customer is needing to solve their problems, then we're actually asking ourselves at that sub-level, how is that supporting what the customer wants? Sometimes you can get so distracted with the noise and people get frustrated. They get frustrated sometimes with some of that noise. They won't, you know, it's why do I have to do this? Well, that's because we are providing this solution to that customer. And remember, that's our key purpose. If we aren't innovating, if we aren't developing, if we aren't implementing that solution, then they'll just go off and buy a commodity product straight into China. What we're doing is we're overlaying it with that focus and that flexibility. So that's why it's important. So it just helps with that conversation of coming back, making sense in the chaos, and really helping to keep the management team focused and aligned rather than fragmented.
Yeah, absolutely. So Fiona, where do you see the business going from here now?
Yeah, the chemical industry in Australia is really quite fascinating over the last decade. There's been a lot of closures and some of the big players have closed down and there's been a lot of amalgamation. So some of the companies are either getting bigger or they're getting out. But I think there's still a real spot for a company like Tritech that sits in that niche between the imported commodity and the big organisations where you provide that agility, that flexibility and that partnership with other players in the chemical industry. And I think we've got a real value to add in that process. And we've certainly been very successful with it over the decades. So I hope that the chemical industry will continue to develop and grow and that Tritech will be an important part of that journey. I think for ourselves personally, it is really about continuing to grow, continuing to work on our strengths, getting better at our strengths. We're putting a lot of activity into, you know, productivity improvement, continuous improvement and innovation. So we've, you know, the owner that's still in the business, we've segregated them out into their own portfolio where they're focused on innovation, so that we can actually have that headspace to think outside what we've done in the past and actually be ahead of where we are today in a systematic way. I think that's such an exciting spot for Tritech to be in and to actually be much more rigorous with the way it's doing something rather than reactive, where we're proactive, we're thinking, we're setting up systems to support that process. And I think that's going to set us up for a great decade to come.
Fantastic. So, Fiona, knowing what you know now, if you went back 10 years, what advice would you give a younger Fiona entering into this kind of role?
I'd definitely say, back yourself and have confidence in you and don't think that you're not you're not enough to do these roles when they pop up. I think when you're a bit younger, you always have that doubt about whether or not you can. And I certainly would say that if someone's asking you to do a role, it means they have confidence in you. So, and have confidence in yourself. I think that's always a really important thing, particularly for professional female. I didn't have a lot of female role models. And actually, have very many at all, to tell you the truth. And so it was always uncertain and unclear what I was trying to do. So I would say have much more confidence in what you're doing. Rely on people. You know, use mentors, use networks. They are really, really important. You can get too internally focused. You can just be, you know, head down, bum up, and you know, getting the job done. Fixing problems, developing systems. I did all those kinds of things. Didn't take the time to actually maintain the networks that I'd had in the past and develop new, more appropriate ones, which is why I mentioned with this CEO masterclass, why that was just so important, because I had let a lot of that slip and I'd become quite isolated and really wasn't thinking about outside the organisation. And as I moved into the CEO role, less about the operations manager, I realised that was just super critical. That was something I'd done that I wish I could go back to myself and say, don't let that slip. That's equally as important as getting the job done.
Yeah. Yeah, very insightful.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au.
So, final question, Fiona. If a founder or a CEO is looking to step out of the business and take an investor or a governance role rather than an operational one, what are the critical few actions they should start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
Definitely redo your strategy, do your OPV, and actually have a real clear alignment on what you want your CEO to do and what success looks like. So you've really got to know that. And it's got to be clearly documented and communicated, and not just with you and the CEO, but the management team underneath. And that alignment is critical. And I would do that first up. I wouldn't hesitate to do that, you know, first up. And then make sure that you're getting enough information on a constant basis to make sure that that is the outcome of that is what you're expecting and what you want, and that you have avenues of intervening in a respectful way that doesn't undermine your CEO, but manages your risk, and having that feedback loop process. And if you don't get it right the first time, then rehash it again. If you don't feel you've got the internal expertise to do it between you and the CEO and your management team, go out and get the expertise and bring them in and facilitate that process. It's not something you can leave to chance.
Oh, Fiona, I think you're absolutely spot on there. I mean, at the end of the day, this process is a substantial transition. It has huge impacts on a founder's sense of identity, has massive impacts on the way that founder interacts with the organization. It leaves a vacuum in their lives, but it also leaves a vacuum in the leadership team, because they're used to having somebody who's so switched on and so engrossed in the business that they're always up to date. And every minute that they're out of the business, they become more out of date. And the transition, by its nature, has to feel uncomfortable if anything's changed at all. And so for me, I guess all of the success of this is underpinned by communication, 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 and then repetition, 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 reinforcing the support there is for the CEO and being ultra cautious not to interfere with that process. And if there are concerns around whether it's on track, then the communication with the CEO is the essential starting point.
Indeed.
Fantastic, Fiona. As always, it's been an absolute delight to talk. Really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualized business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.